You guys are going to be in trouble.
Good afternoon. We are on the record in-house, Labor and Commerce, room 124 at 3:20 p.m. Please turn your cell phones off or turn them to silent. Members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Stutes, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, and myself, Chair Quito. We do have a quorum to conduct business. And support staff today are Caitlin Ellis, our LIO moderator, Ben Manley, our LIO moderator, Caitlin Ellis, our recording secretary, and Kelsey Goodell taking pictures. And Tally Teal, my staff, back from a few days off. We have two issues up for us. One bill, House Bill 229. I'd like to welcome Representative Wohl has joined us. And presentation about our U.S. Census. So what I'd like to do is we heard House Bill 229, oil and gas business bonds, and if we can have the bill sponsor come forward again. I don't think we need to have a re-presentation of the information, but we do want to find out if there are any questions for the bill sponsor. Any questions for the department? I don't have anybody online for public testimony to close out. Is there anybody in the room that would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 229? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. The bill is before us. If we don't have any comments or questions, I would entertain a motion, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I move HB 229 version 30-LS0821/D be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
So any objections to the motion as stated? Seeing no objections, House Bill 229 moves from House Labor and Commerce, and we will take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and come back for the rest of our meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are back on the record, 3:25 p.m., House Labor and Commerce, and we do have Linda Akers-Smith, a geographer with the Los Angeles Regional Office of the U.S. Census Bureau. Ms. Smith, if you can come forward and place your name and affiliation on the record. And looks like we've got a little bit of a PowerPoint presentation. You can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Linda Akers-Smith. I'm a geographer with the U.S. Census Bureau in the Los Angeles Regional Office located in Van Nuys, California. And today I'm going to talk about the road to 2020 census. Thank you. So I want to start today by providing the actual wording of the law. And this is why we do a census, to apportion the 435 seats of the House of Representatives. Once the official results are released, the apportionment occurs. The states in orange are the states that had a net decrease in seats, while the blue states saw an increase. But as you know, it's more than that. It's about fairness. While the decennial census population count is about the apportionment to congressional seats of the states, the legislation is also the basis of federal registration. Federal legislation, including the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and the Fair Housing Act. The decennial count is also the basis for the distribution of over $400 billion annually to the states. So this table that you're looking at was created by the Brookings Institution, and it shows the 10 largest government programs whose distribution is directly tied to population data. And this includes the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Education, the Department of Transportation, and other assistance programs. So on the next slide, looking at the results of the 2010 census, the net results were very good when you compare them to prior censuses. To produce the net results, we do a separate independent operation to measure the outcome, and then we compare it to the results of the census. So the bars above the line are the net undercount, as in the case of the 1980 and 1990 census. In 2000, there was a half percentage overcount. Now, looking at the 2010 census, our results were really good. We had a 0.01% overcount. So from a national data quality perspective, the 2010 results were very good. And this is good, and this is what we want to continue to do. However, on the next slide, conducting a census is very expensive. As the graph shows, the costs of conducting a census have gone up exponentially. We've traditionally done this mostly using pencil and paper, and as our country becomes more diverse, our costs tend to be going up faster than inflation and faster than population growth. And we estimate that if we repeated the census the same as we did in 2010, we would spend over $17 billion. And we can't continue on this path, and Congress has challenged us to drive down the costs of the census. So with that in mind, we're planning on testing several initiatives that we think will drive down the cost of the census, similar to the cost of 2010, adjusted for inflation, yet produce high-quality results. So I'm going to spend a little time on this slide and describe four areas of innovation that we're working on. So the first is the efficiency in building our address list. In 2010, our address list was updated in the field as part of a large-scale field operation where we hired over 150,000 people to travel every road using a handheld device to verify and update our addresses and our roads. But for the 2020 census, the completeness and accuracy remains equally as important, and we'll do a 100% review of our address list. But we will accomplish this using new methodologies and a combination of in-office and in-field review. For the in-office review, we use information from the Postal Service, imagery, commercial databases, and files provided from tribal, state, and local governments. Where sources are not available or there are areas of rapid change, we put people on the ground to update the address list. Our second innovation is to generate the largest possible self-response, thereby reducing the number of households requiring follow-up. To motivate people to respond, we include a nationwide communications and partnership campaign. And this campaign is focused on getting people to respond on their own, as it costs significantly less to process a response provided over the internet or through a paper questionnaire than it does to send a field worker to knock on the door. We're planning on targeting ads to specific audiences and work with trusted voices to inspire participation in the census. We're also working to allow more options to respond from any location at any time via phone, internet, or mobile website. And this time, you don't need a questionnaire to respond. If you see an ad, you can log on and count yourself. If you go to a community event, we might be there with a table and some iPads, and you can go right on and send your response in directly to us. We'll continue to make paper questionnaires available in places such as libraries and post offices and community centers as well. How we handle the delivery of questionnaires and the enumeration of Alaskans varies. In areas where we have an address that can be delivered to a house, we use postal delivery, but in areas where there's no postal delivery to the household, we actually canvass the area, adding any houses not on our list, and then knock on the door and conduct an interview. In the remote and sparsely settled areas of Alaska, we do something very similar, but we work closely with village leaders and start our enumeration activities much earlier. Thirdly, we'll use information we have to reduce expensive in-person follow-up. These data will be used to identify vacant households, determine the best time to visit a household, or count the people and fill in responses with existing high-quality data from trusted sources. We still plan to knock on every door, though. The reduction in the number of visits will definitely lead to significant cost savings. Lastly, we're re-engineering field operations. In 2020, our in-person follow-up was done mostly using pencil and paper. We relied on in-person meetings with staff, and these processes were significant contributors to cost increases. But for the 2020 census, we plan to use technology to more efficiently and effectively manage our 2020 census fieldwork. We're reorganizing the field structure and reducing the number of field offices. We have an operational control system plan that will assist in managing the work, enabling more efficient case assignments and optimizing travel routes, think in the style of UPS. So switching over to the main reasons why we miss people, and this is really important. We know, based on our analysis, that we miss people because we don't have their address in our address file. If we don't have their address, we can't send them a form. And if we get a response, we can't match them to a place on the ground. The second reason why we miss people is we don't get a response. We send a questionnaire, we knock on the door, but no one answers. And thirdly, we get a partial response, the sensitive self-response only. And sometimes children don't get counted. If there are multiple families living in a household, even temporarily, sometimes they don't get counted, as well as unrelated individuals. So to tie in number one, missing of housing units, there is one opportunity to comment on the Census Bureau's address list, and that's through the local update of Census addresses program. The Census Bureau relies on a complete and accurate list to reach every living quarters. If a house is not on our list, then the housing unit and its associated population will not be visited or sent a questionnaire. So in terms of who can participate in the LUCA program, it's states, organized boroughs, incorporated places such as cities and towns, federally recognized tribes with a reservation or off-reservation trust lands, and Alaska Native regional associations. If governments lack the resources or are not eligible to participate, we encourage coordination with participating higher levels of government. Title 13 of the U.S. Code authorizes the Census Bureau's work and provides strong protection for the information that it collects. The commitment to maintain confidentiality and security is critical in gaining and crucial in retaining the public support of our work. LUCA participants must understand that information provided to and from LUCA falls under Title 13, which specifically requires that the Census Bureau ensure confidential treatment of census-related information, including individual addresses and structure coordinates. We're currently doing promotional workshops throughout the country through the summer, both in person and via webinar. We're encouraging tribal, state, and local governments to put a line item in their budget now to ensure staff and resources are allocated for the address review, which actually begins in February of 2018. The workshop provides step-by-step guidance on how to prepare for the program. It also provides suggestions on how to prioritize if a complete review is not possible. So in the packet that I provided, on the right side is a LUCA information guide, which highlights information provided in our workshops. This guide and a letter regarding the program was also sent to the highest elected officials and governors. Also included was a request to identify a contact person for the program. So the next slide shows our LUCA schedule. In January of 2017, we sent out the letters to the highest elected officials. We're out right now doing our promotional workshops. In July, we will do a LUCA invitation mailing, which includes our registration materials. In October, we're going to conduct technical LUCA workshops via in-person workshops and webinars. And December 15th is the deadline for LUCA registration. Between February and April of 2018, the LUCA materials begin to ship to participants. And upon receipt, participants have 120 calendar days to conduct their review and update the Census Bureau's address list. Shortly thereafter, the Census Bureau begins processing the LUCA submissions, and we do our address canvassing operation. And then in between August and September of 2019, we deliver the LUCA feedback to participants. And this is the enumeration list that we plan on using to conduct the 2020 census. So with that, I want to thank you for your time and your interest in Census 2020. And special thanks to the Department of Labor and Liz Brooks, who scheduled to make this happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Akers-Smith. And we've got a question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for a great presentation. I just found a picture of my my 1980 census with my family when it was in April. I did have a question, and I know I think I get it as far as the allocation of like congressional seats and stuff. How do they do it with what happens with you know, a lot of focus on illegal aliens, and you know, and you know, basically people that are in the country that I presumably they can't vote, but how do they count, or do they you count them, and does that contribute to the reallocation of congressional seats, as an example? And I you know, and that's probably something I should have learned in basic government, but I don't recall that. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch. We do count everyone on census day, no matter if they're legal or illegal citizens. So we will send them a questionnaire, and we don't ask citizenship status on the short form questionnaire. We ask age, race, gender, relationship, and tenure, I believe. And those are the questions that we ask on the short form questionnaire.
So follow up. So if, you know, to take it to the extreme, if half of a state's population were there illegally, would that, would it, do you have any way of distinguishing, you know, what that population is and whether or not you're going to reallocate the congressional seats based on that population, irrespective of whether they're here legal or not?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Birch. We do not collect information regarding citizenship or legal status. We just count the population. And so those numbers that we count are provided by March 31st of 2021 to the states for redistricting purposes.
So if a state had several million illegal you know, residents that otherwise couldn't vote, the census doesn't have a mechanism of discerning whether or not they're, you know, reasonably and fairly a part of that state's population for reallocating the congressional seats or not. So it's just an overall number, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Birch. Yes, that's true. States create their own laws in regards to redistricting. So it would be up to them to make the determination of how they would want to do the redistricting. But for the census, we count everyone once in the right place.
Oh, okay.
Well, no matter what their status, citizenship okay. status.
And irrespective of status, that goes into the yeah. count. Second follow-up question would be, what's up with the question? Do you have a list of the questions? I seem to remember seeing, you know, last census, I seem to remember the questions went on, you know, several pages of questions, if I remember right. It was lots of very detailed questions. Is there a prescription for what is permissible as far as the questions, the level of detail of questions, and how those change from year over year? From, presumably from day one, they want to know, you know, who's where and where do you live, but, you know, over time, that's clearly evolved, and I was curious as to who comes up with the questions, and you know, if some of those questions you think are kind of invasive or not. You know, what's the obligation of a constituent to answer all the questions?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, there are two things that we do. Every 10 years, we take a census, a decennial census, and we use only 5 questions, so it's a very short form. Okay. Back in 2000, I believe, we used to have 2 forms. One was the long form, and that did ask a lot of questions, and it consisted of many pages. But in 2010, we separated the two. And so the long form questionnaire, where we ask social characteristics, demographic characteristics, and economic characteristics, is now done through our American Community Survey. And that is done every year. We sample 3 million people, and we do ask a litany of questions regarding social, economic, and demographic characteristics. So we've separated it from the decennial census, so we've streamlined it, so we only ask just the questions necessary to comply with redistricting and other federal laws. We also in March we just published recommendations of the questions that we will ask for Census 2020, which are not going to change, as well as the questions we plan on asking through our American Community Survey. And we've sent that to Congress, and I can get you a copy. And it is a large, long document, but one of the things that we do in preparation for determining the questions that we ask is we work through the Office of Management and Budget. And the Office of Management and Budget works with all federal agencies to determine what their data needs are. And once that happens, we aggregate that information to determine the questions that we need to ask. And then it goes through a review every year. So if legislation or laws change, we will look at our questions and determine if they're necessary to be asked again. We will finalize the questions in March of next year. But I certainly can give that to you. And the memo that I'll provide to you is really interesting in that it provides every question we ask, why we ask it, what agency needs it, and how that questions, the data that we gather from that question, benefits the community at large.
Vlasky, what duty and responsibility does a citizen have to answer the short form questionnaire versus a long form? Is there a legal or constitutional, or, I mean, can somebody just say, you know, kind of blow off the census and say, hey, leave me alone? Do they have that option? And in which case you just kind of go, oh, there's somebody here that doesn't want to talk to me, and then move on? Or is there an obligation to fill out either the short form or the long form vis-a-vis the census person that comes to, ask for that information?
Through the chairman, Representative Birch, I believe there is a law that requires that you answer the questions. We don't put anyone in jail for not asking the question. And we don't use the law to tie anyone's hands to answer the questions. One of the ways that we attempt to educate the public is through, and I think I forgot this slide because it's not on my slide deck, but I would like to talk a little bit about it really quickly, is that we work through local governments through what we call complete count committees. And we met with the governor's staff this morning to request that they name a contact person that we can work with. So what we try to do, and I hope this answers your question, is we try to find trusted voices in the community to carry this message over, to help them understand why it's important to answer the census question and respond to the American Community Survey. And so we try to bring it down to the local level. We try to find ways in which the community would be more willing to respond. They might not care so much about apportionment, but they might care about federal legislation where they benefit, or community block grants which benefit their community. So we try to bring it down to the local level as much as possible to garner participation. There are some instances where no matter how hard we try, we're not going to get a response. It's a very small number of people, and in those cases, we try to impute the data, looking at characteristics of the geography and the responses that we receive around it, and that's a very, very small population.
Thank you, Representative Sullivan-Munner.
Thank you, through the chair. I hate to admit it, but I'm one of those stubborn people. Didn't want to fill out all of the information on the census sheets that were provided to me. The information that, especially for the long form, was information that, you know, I could see what you're trying to glean from the community, but found it to be very invasive. How can we then, as citizens and representatives to the members in our district, have a say in this? I know there are folks in my district, in particular in Wasilla, who really many times you won't even find an address on their home. Mailbox is non-existent. You walk up the driveway, you may be greeted by a dog and a gun, and that's kind of the, just how they are. But how can we, again, have a say in this so that it's not so invasive? I can understand where you want to have, you know, the information of myself, my age, that's fine, my address, how many children still live in the home. But when it goes, you know, beyond that, how much is too much?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I understand your concerns in this day and age. There's a lot of information that's out there. It's a lot of information folks are collecting from us, whether we're on the internet or not. And I realize that for some people, it's very difficult to give this information out, especially with the amount of fraud that occurs. I think if we can help educate you on why the questions are asked, that might give you a better understanding. One of the things that we would really like to do is to work with you and your communities to educate you a little bit better of why it would be beneficial to you, and that's through our complete count committees, where if we can find a connection of why someone should respond, why they should give us their address, why they should return a census questionnaire, I think we will get a better response. And, of course, that goes back to our redistricting, the Voting Rights Act, and for funding. I think that's important. A lot of folks do get funding through programs. Census Bureau uses population counts for funding. So if we can, we have to find ways to connect with people to help them understand why it's important.
Sure, and just follow up if I could, Mr. Chairman. And I understand that. I'm just wondering maybe if there's a different venue that you could use regarding funding that you're seeking. But truly, you know, there should be also a piece where if someone gives the general information, they shouldn't be excluded. I mean, I had four different census people come to my home, finally had the Northwest director, Sharon Anderson, come up from California, somebody I actually knew, and we sat and talked about it. But I think there needs to be a little give and take, too. You can't say you have to do this based on federal funding that we want to receive or grants that you may be able to obtain in your particular district or across the state, so you have to fill this out. There needs to be, I think, a little bit of leniency in that. Anyway, that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I guess I have a comment question as well. So, and thank you for answering the question about how the questionnaires are put together. I did work a little bit on the census back in 2000, and I think there were some discussions about how to make the process more efficient. At that time, there was some discussion about actually utilizing some statistical techniques. I think ultimately that was pulled back, but that was maybe where they started talking about splitting out the long form from the short form. And we had a lot of discussions in coming up to 2000 about what the benefits or detriments of not being fully compliant with the census. Having worked for the Department of Transportation at the time, the big issue for us was having an accurate count for our state, because state population was a very big factor in how much we receive from the federal government in allocations in the Federal Highway Program as well as the Federal Aviation Program. Some of the formulas actually use the decennial census population to determine how much money we receive for those programs. And I didn't know much about the other programs, but I do appreciate hearing that the long form is using the statistical methods to try and estimate who is responding in what way. And I guess my question out of all of that understanding, kind of how we ended up where we're at, using the statistical techniques, are there ways that you go through and try and ground truth whether or not you're projecting accurate information by the sample of 3 million people?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I can answer that question very well, so I might have to follow up with you. But one of the things that we do is that when we project information from the American Community Survey, we only ask 3 million people every year. And what we do is we aggregate the data over time to create smaller population estimates. So the smallest population or the smallest data estimates we use for the American Community Survey are the block groups. And the block groups, we use 5 years of ACS data in order to get a good estimate. So one of the things that we do is we use many years in order to do an estimation. With every estimation that we do, we also have a margin of error, and the margin of error lets you know how accurate or inaccurate that data is. So with every piece of data, we'll give you a margin of error, because some populations can be very, very small, and when so the margin of error will be very high.
So and thank you for that. And I think maybe as another question that might help Representative Sullivan Leonard, is there a committee or a process for coming up with the questions for the community survey? You say that you've got information that designates which agency is requesting the question and why. Is there a process for having a group of people come together and say these are the questions we need to have asked in the community survey?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is. We actually not only we work through community groups to gather information on the best way to ask these questions. And so as part of this package that I'll provide to you, it'll explain what federal agency is asking the question. And I believe I also have some documentation on the process of working with community groups to come up with some of the questions and to reword some of the questions. So we do have a process for that, and I can provide that to you as well for ACS.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I add something as well?
Certainly.
You brought up a very good point about some of the statistical methods that we use. And for the 2020 census, one of the statistical methods that we're using is administrative records. So we're using information that we already have to get answers from folks that don't return the questionnaire. Some examples would be we send out a questionnaire and it comes back from the Postal Service as undeliverable as addressed. So we think that is vacant, so we'll go in and visit it, ensure it's vacant, and then we won't go back out and visit again. In the 2010 census, we would do visits of up to 6 personal visits. We are not doing that anymore. What we are doing is we will attempt to make a visit, and if we don't get a response, then we will use, if we have really good quality administrative records data, using trusted sources that we already have with the federal government or administrative records from states or other organizations, we will use that information to determine the status of that particular household. So we are reducing the number of visits.
Thank you. And Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had in one of your graphs the amount of overcount or undercount. I'm just curious, if what you're doing is counting population, how do you know, what are you comparing it to know if you're over or under? I missed the details on that one.
So we have a separate operation that we do, and it's independent of the decennial census. It's called our Census Coverage Measurement Program. And so we sample a small population that's stratified throughout the United States, and we do a completely separate operation. We create our own address list. We have a separate staff, separate from the regular decennial census workers, and we collect that information separately. We then, in addition to making personal visits and collecting the same information, we will go back multiple times and we will ask coverage questions. Is there anyone that we were missing? Is there any children that are at college or staying in dormitories? So we ask a lot of additional coverage questions, and then we compare the results of that to the census count to figure out to get our over coverage or under coverage results.
Follow up. Thank you. So obviously using one is sort of more accurate, I guess, if one is over or under that. So I have two questions, and one, your graph of how much it costs, that it goes up. Why does it go up as much as it does? And especially, you're saying you're getting away from paper and pencil. If the digitization aspect of it would make it more efficient, I mean, to go for, I mean, each year went up billions of dollars, and I know there's more people, but it's not that much more. So, in other words, why does it go up so much?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I think one of the reasons is because it's a lot more difficult to count people nowadays. We are a society that tends to move around a lot more than we used to 30 years ago. There's a lot of different living situations right now, and we are spending more money trying to capture information from people because people aren't aware of what the census does. They are not aware of the importance, and they don't very easily answer the census questionnaire. So we spend a lot more of our time trying to get a return questionnaire. So I think that's most of where the money's spent.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along those lines, I remember when I was a kid, it must have been the 1970 census. Okay, it was the 1960. I'm just kidding. No. Years ago. It wasn't the 80. I was older. I was too old then. But I remember it was kind of a big deal. You know, it came to the house, and it was kind of interesting and fun. And I don't know when that changed into more sort of hostility. And I know the 2010, I knew people in Fairbanks that were working to get census, going door to door and being chased away with sometimes armed individuals, which, you know, maybe Representative Birch can help me on that a little bit. But so anyhow, I don't know when it changed from, like, this is fun to, like, get off my land. But with your adaptation of a short form, long form, and only, what, one out of 100 people or so getting the long form, does that make it easier and cheaper to implement? So I guess two questions. When did it switch fun and friendly as not so fun and friendly? I'm not saying it isn't, but, and does the short form, long form, when did that happen, and does that save time and money?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'm not sure when it went from fun and friendly to not so fun. Maybe society has changed a little bit since then, and people are inundated with information now and asked to give a lot of their information, and a lot of information is taken from them. I don't think I can answer that question. And I'm not sure if Liz can add anything to that. So, the second question, short form versus long form. The last time we did that was in, I'm going to have to look that up. I think the last time that we did that was in 2000, where we had the short form and the long form. And then we started the American Community Survey in 2005. And that's where the long form data is collected now. So, the 2000 census is probably the last time that we used the long form data. ACS started, the American Community Survey started in 2005. So in the 2010 census, we only collected short form data. And in the 2020 census, we'll also only collect short form data. I think in terms of costs, I don't think it would be costly to collect the long form data, because folks that got the long form were more likely not to respond initially. So we had a lower response rate due to the long form. So there was additional costs in attempting to collect information. It was a very long interview. And if you had 10 people in your household, it could take a very long time to complete that interview.
I think, Representative Wohl, your question about when did it change, I think there was a gradual process. So if you think back to the 1970s, the Social Security number that we all are given was used for a lot of things. There were some issues about some people getting hold of the Social Security number, but it wasn't really that big that I recall until kind of maybe a little bit in the 80s, but definitely through the 90s, where individuals became much more concerned about the proliferation of their personal data. And so I do think maybe we probably saw a shift between the 1990 and 2000 census, but I think there were probably people that were still quite concerned in 1990. There are probably some research fellows out there that have done some studies or papers on that if you wanted to look that up. But
one last follow-up small question, and then I'm done. Thank you very much for answering these questions for me. So if I understand it right, the anyone who gets the census in 2020, it'll be short form, 5 questions. So what Representative Sullivan Leonard or others are saying, well, there was just too many questions. I didn't want to answer them all. It was too intrusive. Right now, the only questionnaire a census responder is going to get is 5 questions about how many people live in their house and et cetera, et cetera. And then that's it. They're on their way. And the long form is a different survey. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Birch.
I didn't want to imply that we had unpleasant experiences with census. It was always actually it was kind of a monumental occasion around our house, and I've got actually have some very poignant photos of the census person in Fairbanks counting our family and all. But what does the data that is applied short term, in one form or another, is that available to research folks, without attribution or, in other words, is the data out there and accessible to folks that the government wants it accessible to, even if it's not tied back to a specific individual? I'm just curious as to, you say 72 years before it's publicly, you can hang my questionnaire around me, but can you aggregate information, next year or shortly after it's gathered?
Yes, we do take data, and we remove all personally identifiable information from the data, mix it up somewhat, and make it available to researchers through our public use microdata samples. Okay. And I don't know, Liz, if you've worked with that data. So, yes, we do, and that happens right after the census.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Akersmith, for the presentation. And I have a question, final question. Are there things that we need to be doing at the state level now coming up into 2018 or 2019?
Mr. Chair, I am so glad you asked that question because I, for some reason, lost one of my slides. There are a few things that we would like to ask you to do. So we are going to be doing a national campaign, and we are going to start our outreach. We have already hired a partnership specialist who has experience working Census 2010 as a recruiting assistant in the remote Alaska areas. She's working directly with the Native Alaskan and village areas. She is out there right now communicating with the local government. She was in Southeast Alaska last week, meeting with some governments and encouraging them to participate in the LUCA process. What we would like to see is to have the state participate in the LUCA program any way that you can, whether it's reviewing addresses or encouraging local governments to participate in the program and to review their address list. Because, again, if we miss a housing unit, we're going to miss all of the population within it. So we really encourage participation in the LUCA program. The next thing is we need to take our message to the local level. We need to help the population, the Alaskans, understand why it's important to conduct the census and who better to tell Alaskans than other Alaskans. So we want to work with the communities, and we do need someone at the executive level to help us create what we call a complete count committee. And that's a committee that works with our partnership staff, and that helps direct different types of campaigns to get information out about the census and why it's important. In your packet, there's a couple pieces of legislation that's passed that have been passed by the state of New York and the state of Illinois. And those pieces of legislation are establishing complete count committees now. The other thing we would want to request is that there's possibly a line item in your budget so you can support work of the complete count committee.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the information, and we'd be happy to continue working with you.
Thank you very much.
So we do not have anything coming before our committee anymore today, and we have canceled the committee meetings for Friday and Saturday. Our next committee meeting is scheduled for next Monday. Thank you all for attending. With that, we are adjourned at 4:08 p.m. Thank you.